Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us only sky. Imagine all the people living for today.
Welcome. I'm Anne Wilson, and I am delighted to welcome you to Emerge Australia's 2025 podcast series, in which I have the pleasure to speak with a range of individuals, patients, clinicians, and researchers impacted by and associated with ME/CFS and long COVID. I acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which we meet, and pay my respects to elders past, present, those emerging, and listening to this podcast. This year, we are once again listening to Bloom, Emerge Australia's ambassador, singing her beautiful rendition of John Lennon's Imagine. The lyrics and music are just timeless, and they take us to a place where we dare to imagine a world where there is no greed or hunger, no war, where we have a brotherhood of man, maybe a world without discrimination or stigma, a world where there is a cure for ME, where the voices of those suffering invisibly are listened to, seen, and heard, where we imagine all the people. Today, I'm delighted to interview Professor Roz Gledow, and her husband, Professor Andy Gledow. Roz is Emerita Professor of Plant Sciences at Monash University and a Fellow of the Australian Academy of Science, amongst her many accolades. She's a plant biologist and the mother of Eliza Charlie, Emerge Australia's newest ambassador who lives with ME. Roz is a key member of Team Eliza, supporting her daughter in whatever way is helpful to her, reading and evaluating the latest research, and amplifying information about ME on social media. Her husband, Professor Andy Gledow, is a geologist and Emeritus Professor of Earth Sciences at the University of Melbourne. As Eliza's father, he is a key member of Team Eliza as well, supporting his daughter living with ME, working with his wife and others to do everything possible to improve Eliza's life and to alleviate the impact of this pernicious condition. The bios of both Roz and Andrew are illustrious across the disciplines in which they excel professionally. However, I feel it is safe to say their major focus and mission lies in the support of their daughter, Eliza. Roz and Andy, welcome to this podcast. It is such a pleasure to speak with you both today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So I didn't read out all your amazing professional achievements and accolades. Suffice to say, the bios are long and unbelievably impressive. So congratulations on what are amazing achievements.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In thinking about our discussion today, though, I thought it would be good to obtain a bit of a glimpse from you as Eliza's parents of what it was like for you as a family prior to Eliza getting sick. How did your family journey with ME begin? And can you just talk a little bit about that and take our listeners through a bit of your journey as a family?
Well, we were fairly slow to understand what was going on. I think that's the first thing to say. It was, it, it Eliza first became ill after she had already left home and was living with her then partner. And so we were not in day-to-day contact with her, unlike many other parents of ME sufferers who've had to endure this from, through teenage years and so on. Eliza started her long journey with ME in her early 20s. And we, at that time, we only saw her on the occasions where she had the strength and determination, I've got to say, we now know, to actually make a public appearance to come and see us or some family gathering, whatever. So we were seeing a very biased sample of her life, and it only gradually, gradually dawned on us just how serious her condition was.
Yeah, I'd just like to reiterate that. I think it took us a very long time to realize how sick she was, and there are a number of reasons for that. Firstly, when she first became sick, we were actually overseas on sabbatical. So we're both now members, fellows of the Australian Academy of Science. I was kind of like, peak career, I guess. Everything was finally coming together after having to had some time out with the children when they were younger. So we were very occupied with our careers and very busy, and we did see her and her partner, but we didn't appreciate just how sick she was. And I think we never doubted that she was sick. So I know that some
No.
people have to deal with that. We never doubted she was sick, but I'd say it took years and years to realize how sick she was. And in fact, even now, as looking back at those early days, we realize how sick she was at that time.
Yeah, it's interesting hearing you speak because I've had a not dissimilar experience with one of my children who contracted Epstein-Barr virus and then was diagnosed, this is many years ago, with chronic fatigue syndrome. And I recall I just went, go to bed and rest. I completely ignored it. And today I feel guilty about that because it's only really been in the last 4 years that since I've been at Emerge Australia, nearly 4 years, that I've developed any kind of knowledge or appreciation of what she was going through during that period of time. And so I feel dreadful about it. So I kind of relate to that little piece of you as parents at that time.
And if I could just, I was going to add to that. So, I was very busy with work at that time, but it turned out that they didn't live that far from Monash Uni where I work. So I would, often cook up a big casserole, drop it in on the way, and maybe on the way home, I'd drop in and do the washing up. Not really, none of that's particularly a lot of stuff. But what I didn't realize when I'd drop in was that me chatting away, which is what I do, was exhausting. I didn't understand that that's that there, and I don't think any of us did, that social activity and cognitive activity was exhausting for her. And I just didn't realize that. And I think with many other diseases, when someone gets sick, the medical teams come in, the parents and partners get educated about how to handle the person who's sick, and you don't, we didn't get any of that, and there isn't any of that around.
Yes, absolutely. In terms of the rest of your family, what was the impact?
I think their experience would have been the same as ours. They were only seeing Eliza when she was able to be seen, and so weren't aware of the seriousness of the underlying condition. And we've talked this over with Eliza on a number of occasions about how, our growing awareness, because she herself wasn't aware of it and was getting all kinds of medical advice at the time, which led her into graded exercise therapy, for example, as one thing. And she was pushing herself and then crashing, and really learning through that process what her limits were. I mean, she was always a very active person. She was a runner and was still trying to run at that time, and walking and pushing her exercise boundaries, and exceeding them, of course, because that's the nature of the program, and then crashing and really being confused by it. But we weren't seeing this.
No.
This was very, so she was in her own personal battle to come to grips with this, of what was going on and all the confusion that surrounded it. And then she gradually started to get better. For, you know, possibly various reasons, various things she was doing, she was learning to do, she was learning to pace herself. But she, over very slowly over a number of years, did start to improve.
Yeah, and just the other thing with people in our situation might recognize is that your child's left home, they're with their partner. You don't want your blooming mother-in-law coming around all the time, sitting on the doorstep. You don't want that. And so we did keep them at arm's length because we felt like they needed their own life. Of course, hindsight's a wonderful thing.
Oh, I relate so well to what you're saying because they're your child, and
Yes.
you know that your child is suffering, and at the same time, you need them to live their life and be independent. But the impact on you as a parent is, what can we do?
Yeah. And of course, you want to fix it as a parent.
Of
And
course, I'm going to find a cure. And I would think,
yeah.
with your professional prowess, you'd be saying there's got to be
Yeah.
something we can do here.
That was very much our underlying attitude, whether it was stated or not, that there must be something we can do, or you can do, you know. To,
Yes.
it's almost sort of pull your socks up kind of thing, which
Well,
I mean, it's terrible. To
I mean,
look
not
back
really.
on.
Yeah,
We
not really.
didn't say it like
No, I
that,
don't think we really thought that.
but it was certainly, if you don't understand what's going on, you don't understand the boundaries and the limits of what is possible. And so, I mean, it took many years for this to really dawn on us.
And as scientists, and I come from a very large medical family. You just assume that the medical profession is going to come in. Now, there are some fabulous doctors, don't let me get wrong, and but what they have been taught and the consensus of current opinion of clinicians even to today in Australia is that graded exercise, cognitive behavior therapy will work, and it's kind of don't worry about it too much, and yet there are many other things you can do. So I'd assumed that this would happen, that there would be treatments, there would be help. Maybe if there was something we should be doing, someone would tell us. And it again took years to realize that that's an old paradigm that doesn't work for ME. And when Eliza, she did get better and was vastly improved, not 100%, but went through a period of remission. And then when she became extremely ill in 2021, 2022, I think that was, she was so sick. I mean, she was, I mean, I think
She
it's
was
sort of,
bedridden, basically.
yeah, she was bedridden. I mean, she was bed tethered for a while, but then she was bedridden. And, we went to visit her. By then she was living, been overseas, and it was shocking, absolutely shocking. And we realized, I think, that to quote Eliza's words, the cavalry is not coming. We have to work out what we can do. And I think at that point we sat down and thought, we're going to get educated about this, we're going to read the literature. She was in contact with some new researchers. We got in touch with those researchers. We have channels, we know people. We could talk with the people who were doing the research. We had Zoom calls with them. We met them in person to really try and work out, well, what can be done? What do we know now? It's imperfect. Like, we haven't got the full double-blind placebo-controlled trials. We don't have time to wait. These people are so sick. You have to do something. And it's not like I can say, oh, we don't know what to do, so let's do nothing. Doing nothing is not an option. These people are too sick. We have to try stuff that has at least some evidence, you know, like, and there are things that are there where there is a growing body of knowledge that is really encouraging, but it takes some digging and some careful reading, wearing our scientific hats, I think, to really get to, okay, these things are really worth exploring. We really support you in going on this. This one, not so much evidence. Perhaps take it carefully on this one, and so on.
I can imagine that there are many people who will be listening to this podcast saying, you know, you are saying everything that we're thinking, you know, what do you think from the knowledge that you've acquired needs to happen? I'm asking that question.
I think there's a lot of things that need to happen, but one thing I was thinking just this week is, you know, we've had our own medical issues. You know, I had prostate cancer 13 years ago, had a radical prostatectomy and all that stuff, and it's all, fortunately for me, it's all been really good. But I remember that every time I went to see the surgeon or the, you know, and have some more tests of one sort or another, I was given information, not just for me, but for my family, for Roz, constantly. I mean, I was almost drowning under information, what to expect, what, you know, what are the possible outcomes, what are, you know, what impact will this have on your life? And I mean, as it turned out, most of it hasn't been terribly relevant because I've had a very, very good outcome, and here I am 13 years later. But it really struck me that, and every other deal, I've had various other operations most people at our age have had. In every case, there is this provision of information about what to expect, what we understand about this, what we can and can't do. And I see no reason at all that this couldn't also be the case here. It's now abundantly obvious that you can identify, you can, sure, there isn't a quick and simple blood test. You know, give some blood and in 24 hours you know exactly what you've got. There's nothing like that. But the combination of factors in this are a very clear syndrome that make a diagnosis highly likely, at least. So you can't hide behind that. But the ordinary GPs are basically left in the dark. They're left in the, they say, well, it's hard to diagnose, but you know, this is probably the case, and really there's not much we can do. Well, that's really not true.
That's giving up.
And it's really not true. There are things you can do to alleviate symptoms, to improve the quality of life. And that's what we've gradually learned by reading the literature, by talking to people. But I mean, our, you know, Eliza herself, this is what she has been spending her best moments over the last few years when she had this terrible relapse. She has spent a lot of time delving into the literature, and of course we are able to access the whole of the scientific literature. So she's constantly making requests to us, could you get this paper and follow this up? And then we've made contact with some of the people and talked about it. There are things that you can do that make a material difference to the sufferers, and it is not good enough that there is no advice to doctors about what to do. There are many things that could be done and should be done.
Yeah, well, I guess you're preaching our mantra. You know, we are currently in the process of lobbying as hard as we can to ensure that our federal government in the March budget brings down a decision that will fund clinical education. It's not that our GPs are not knowledgeable, they just don't know how to diagnose or recommend management and treatment for people with ME. And it's just got to happen. So the voices of experience of people like both you, Andy, and Roz, who are scientists, are so important to be heard. And we're so glad that we're able to hear what your suggestions are, because they come from the front line. One of the biggest challenges, of course, that you know and you've talked about, are the fact that patients aren't believed. It is very, very hard when I hear people say to me that they've gone to their doctor and their doctor says, look, you need to go and get some therapy because it's all in your mind. It's all psychosomatic. You're not really experiencing this. It's just.
I think this is terrible, because it shouldn't happen with illness, but it should be taken seriously. And part of that is because there isn't the biomarker. However, there are suites of symptoms, and many diseases are initially, often for decades, diagnosed that way before they find the underlying cause. And I think I used to teach a course on the history and philosophy of science, and part of that was teaching about Kuhnian approaches to paradigm shifts in science, so Thomas Kuhn. And you have this set view of what things are, and everybody operates in that paradigm. You can't imagine it. A paradigm is a way of looking at things, and everything is seen through that lens. Now, then you have sort of proto-science, which is little bits and pieces that start to create anomalies in the paradigm. That's where we've been for the last 20 years. Anomalies. It doesn't fit, it doesn't fit, it doesn't fit. And then eventually you get this crisis in science where the old paradigm is clearly wrong and the new paradigm is yet to crystallize. And that is the point where we're at right now. There is a new paradigm crystallizing about the pathophysiology of this disease, to do with mitochondria, oxygen delivery to cells, vascular problems, things with the blood, neurological conditions. This is all going to come together in a new paradigm. At the moment, it's a little unclear, but it will come. And the classic thing with a paradigm shift is that they're nearly always driven by younger people, and they're nearly always driven by people outside the field. And our experience of reading the literature as this paradigm shift, with a few exceptions, of course, is not driven by clinicians or people in the field. It's been driven by biochemists or people who study blood cells or something, or maybe people who come from cardiology rather than from infectious diseases. And they're the ones driving it. And I think, Andy, you were saying something about the how important this is.
I think it's tremendously important to see and understand how science changes. It actually doesn't change by the consensus of the old people, which is what determines things like advice to GPs. Essentially, it's a very conservative, and it's right to be conservative in many ways in these things, but. The changes come from people looking at things and think there's something going on here. There's something actually really interesting from a research point of view. I look at all this stuff, and as a researcher, as someone who spent 50 years, more than 50 years in research, I look at this and I think, if I was a young person today, this is the kind of thing I would really, really be interested to get into, to really understand what a really interesting problem. There's something going on here that nobody really understands. Somebody will be the person that puts all that together, and they're going to actually lead a new wave of, they'll lead the paradigm shift. And it'll be hard, there'll be opposition, But there are going to be breakthroughs. You can see breakthroughs all around, just waiting to be picked up in this field, in this research field. And we've found from our own discussion with researchers and people involved in the field that there isn't a resistance to this amongst researchers. Researchers are really they're interested in an interesting problem. And they can see whether something doesn't fit, whether an old explanation is simply not working. And I suspect there's a whole generation. I hope this is true, and I hope that maybe long COVID is encouraging people to get into this, itching to have a crack at the very exciting and interesting research problems that are there for the taking right now. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, the biggest challenge we face in ME is that whilst the federal government has invested $50 million in long COVID research through the MRFF, since 2018, 19, where there was $3 million for a targeted call for research funded by the then government, there has been $0 spent on ME research. And that's one of the biggest challenges that we as a sector face, because as you would be aware, at the end of 24, there was a long COVID inquiry that brought down a report that had recommendation 8 in it. And in that recommendation, it recommended basically four areas, and that is the funding of clinical guidelines, which the current Labor government funded in May last year, which was amazing, a landslide announcement after 22 years of radio silence from governments. So that was a huge achievement. We need to fund clinical education because there is none other than the little bits and pieces that Emerge Australia provides on the smell of an oily rag. We need to fund ME CFS research. It needs to be funded.
It does,
No research funding coming out of government for ME CFS research. It's not good enough to say we're doing a lot of long COVID research and some of that research might benefit people with ME CFS, said a former medical officer. We need to expand patient services because people with ME need help. They need to be supported.
I do.
They need access to the very resources that you're talking about, Andy, that you got when you were diagnosed with prostate cancer. You could do this, or you could might be able to do that. Read this, go here, talk to that person. In order to do that, you have to have people who are trained and you've got to be able to pay staff. So that needs to happen. And then we have the whole access and equity issue around the access to the NDIS and the disability support pension. And there are so many people who need that kind of help. Are there other challenges that you've encountered in your journey as Eliza's parents and members of Team Eliza? Are there challenges that have to do with how you feel about it, your own frustrations, maybe the frustrations of your family? What brick walls have you been banging into that have caused you huge frustration where you've felt that you haven't been able to move forward?
A couple of things I'd like to come in with there. One of the things that when I realized that Eliza was so sick, and this is really very recent, this is only really in the last 3 years, she needs someone to manage her medical appointments, help her order medicines, just sort of life admin. We all have life admin, but life admin is exhausting. And when you're sick, life admin is complicated because you have all these extra things. So I think understanding the need for that has been important. And then, of course, that does take my time. I mean, I'm happy to spend it, but it is, If I was younger and, at the stage of my career I was 15 years ago when she started to get sick, it would be very hard for me to spend that sort of time at that point, whereas I do have the opportunity to do it now. That's one thing. Another thing is that because we lead an international life, and so does Eliza, there are some treatments that are only available in certain countries. And so in Europe you can easily get such and such medical on the public health. In Australia it's going to cost you $500, but in Australia you can get this one for $39, but in Europe that's going to cost you $200. So you've got these complicated things, and it's extremely expensive because this stuff, some of it's proto-science, so it's not fully proved. Some of it is fully proved, but it's not on the PBS. So it's incredibly expensive, hundreds and hundreds of dollars, and if thousands of dollars. And you have to, for anybody that doesn't have access to those resources, it is completely inequitable. And even for us who are connected into these communities and have spent years as in professorial positions, we've had to do crowdfunding because it's just impossible for one family to do that. Well, there needs to be some sort of government support for people to access medications that we know actually help.
Can you give us any insight into some of the overseas treatments or the types of medication that maybe Eliza has trialed that have helped? Is there any guidance as to, directions that we may need to be pushing our authorities as far as treatments are concerned?
Um,
Sure,
well, yeah, I think one thing I think would be really good is in Australia if we could at least have microclot testing, because there's a lot of research about these little microclots that the blood clots too readily, and it also in the blood vessels you can see them. But also, I know with Eliza, she cuts herself. She doesn't bleed. It just clots immediately on the surface of the skin. She's got very thick blood, I guess. So some of the treatments that were that they're in Germany, not treatments, were is actually testing for microclots, and that's come out of Rhesus Pretorius's work in South Africa, and Doug Pell
Dunkell in Liverpool,
in Liverpool, and Beate Jäger in Germany have done a lot of work on this. And so I think having testing, it's not hard. It's just you need a fluorescent microscope. I mean, how many of those do we have in Australia? I don't know. I've got one,
They're everywhere. I've
they're
got one.
everywhere. So, you just need to have someone who knows how to do that. That wouldn't be hard. And then you'd say, okay, this person's got microclots. If they've got microclots, what do you then do? Well, maybe they might need some more oxygen because their blood's not working. So that's easy to treat. They might need blood thinners. That's easy. You can get them on the PBS. But another treatment that we've come across that in her case, and this will not be for everyone. So I think this is the key thing. We know that myalgic encephalomyelitis is a complex disorder, and not everybody presents in the same way. So what I'm saying now is an experience of a single person under conditions. But there's a treatment, apheresis treatments, which can actually filter out the microclots and actually reduce their prevalence in your blood. And for her, that's been good. But of course, that's not going to treat everybody. Again, that equipment could be adapted from equipment that already exists in Australia. I don't think it would be very expensive.
It was, the clinic originally in Mulheim, in up on the Ruhr, we were there when she first started this treatment, this apheresis, a blood filtration treatment basically. And this has been adapted. These apheresis machines are quite commonly used in Europe for various things, for leukemia patients, for heart patients who don't respond to statins, for a whole lot of things. Basically, taking things out of blood that aren't helpful. And this, but these microclots are actually an amyloid protein, which might start people thinking about other possible diseases.
Yeah,
The
absolutely.
distorted misfolded protein that is not behaving as it should, but these little microclots are actually of sufficient dimensions that they can clog microcapillaries and prevent. This is the theoretical basis behind the thing, but it's not. And Dr. Yeager, who was running this clinic when we first went there, she said, "We're running way ahead of the research, but there is tremendous demand for this, and many patients, the majority of patients, are seeing real benefit from it, and some are having almost miraculous cures almost overnight."
Yeah, I mean, not
Yeah,
everyone. So we have to
not
make
every.
the proviso, I think,
There are
that not for
some
everybody.
that don't, but most do get some response, and our Eliza managed to get into this program back in
22, middle of
2022,
22.
and that's when she was coming from 18 months of being, housebound and bedridden and at a terribly low ebb. And we took her in there in a wheelchair, and as many of the patients who go in there were. And it really helped, but it took multiple treatments, multiple rounds of this, and each treatment takes about 3 hours and costs an extraordinary amount of money. And most people, it would simply be beyond them. We really struggled ourselves. We're not hard up, but this was more than we could do.
Expensive, yeah.
Now
And
costs even more, but it certainly changed things for her, changed her baseline.
you have to have that treatment on a regular basis. So does Eliza now need to go every so often to have it, or
You might be best to ask her about that question. So she did actually get COVID last year, which set her back years in terms of recovery. And she did manage to go back and get some more treatment at that point, which seemed to help.
It got her back onto the slowly upward trajectory she was
It's
on,
very slow.
before.
But I mean, I just think that those things aren't, they're not complicated. They would be things we could do here, but I think the key thing is if we could do the testing here, then at least people would know, is this true broadly of myalgic encephalomyelitis patients in Australia? And I think once you've got a test like that, then the treatments become fairly obvious what you'd need to do. And this is what I'm talking about, the paradigm shift. This is completely different way of looking at it. And I know there are other neurological things, and that's we haven't gone that route in the same way. But then once you've made that shift, you just can't even believe that people would go back to thinking in the old paradigm. I mean, the old paradigm just doesn't make sense.
It's interesting because one would think that with long COVID, and of course the presence of microclots, is one of the areas that has been identified with people who have long COVID, that you'd think there was some form of testing here for people, or for microclots in the body. Does that not happen in long COVID at all? Do you know?
Don't believe
Because
it happens in Australia.
you don't believe it happens in
I
Australia
mean,
either.
I could be wrong. I wouldn't know every possible outlet that might do this, but as far as we're aware, it's not available in Australia.
Mind you, he's a geologist and I'm a plant biologist,
Oh.
so we're not exactly embedded in the medical profession.
But you're scientists, and you make a lot of sense. I mean, one would think, in my lay person's view, that one would think that anything that could identify the presence of microclots in the blood would impact cardiovascular health. It would be instructive in the diagnosis of a range of conditions that could lead to, very serious health issues, not just a long COVID, but really could have a huge diagnostic impact on how you address these diseases. So I think it's certainly worth pursuing, and may even be something that we could follow up with you later on and see if we could get a little bit of a paper together on it, because We need to be able to present these things to government. We need to present them to ministers. They need to hear the stories of people like you who have lived with this for so long and still are chasing the answers to help your daughter. Quite incredible stories. I was going to ask you what you regard as the most positive developments in ME globally that you feel have either helped Eliza or may help Eliza in the future, apart from you're looking at things like being able to diagnose microclots and looking for them and then doing something about them and the apheresis, etc. Are there any other developments that you see from the literature that you read that would give hope to people with ME in Australia?
I think the first thing I'd like to say in answer to that is there seems to be a lot happening. And that's different. If you look at older literature going back 10 years, not much was happening. But there does seem to be a little bit of a chain reaction beginning here, which is very encouraging. And it's not just microclots. And I mean, some of the researchers we've spoken to really think that the microclots are it, and they may be right. But others say, well, yes, it's one factor. There are things going on with the mitochondria. There is very clearly a failure of the vascular system to deliver oxygen to where it's needed.
And for the
And
mitochondria to use that oxygen. So
use
there definitely seems to be a problem with mitochondrial function. And there's been a lot of papers coming out that new research just in the last 2 or 3 months. So I think this is very encouraging that there's a lot of research showing this is sort of one of the big things that is happening is that there is quite a lot of research. And I think that that's encouraging. I think once we flip over the paradigm, the sooner the better. And I'm not quite sure what the final answer is, but once that flips, things will change very, very quickly. So we're at this stage where all the anomalies, we know the old one doesn't work, but the new one is not clear yet, but there is a lot happening. And my advice to people in the medical profession is, okay, let's take Galileo. Do you want to be Galileo or do you want to be, the established church that said,
You can't save the
the moons
country.
don't, you can't, which side of history do you want to be on?
Yeah, absolutely. Is there anything we can do to speed up that paradigm shift from your perspective? If you were talking to members of parliament right now, what would you be telling them to speed up that paradigm shift? What should
I
they do?
think more money for research, and being, I would have the research controlled by the researchers rather than the clinicians, because clinicians are not, nothing much is happening yet in terms of clinical results from the research. But there is a very clear momentum in the research, and that should be encouraged at every point. And in the end, that takes money. There is a lot that individual researchers, I mean, it's such a rich field that even individual researchers with very little money can almost certainly make a difference. And then that will start to open the floodgates, as it were, for the financing of much bigger studies and putting it into, translating that into clinical practice. And that starts to get really expensive when you get to that point. But things are happening, and that's exciting.
Yeah, the other thing that I would recommend to government is that we do absolutely need to update those guidelines. And I know that they're starting to do that. I'm concerned that it's going to take so long, it's going to take years because our GPs need support to help people at this point. And at the moment, the guidance that's provided is very measured, let's just put it that way. And I think that that could be improved. So, and also the education of both GPs, but education of like families. Like, if we could have been more aware, like 15 years ago, when you drop in, don't just sit there and chat. Just do a few things and then get out of there and get it quiet. Sure, get some noise cancelling headphones. That's really helpful. There's lots of stuff that can happen, and maybe, there are, I think, some education of families, and as
Well,
well as
advice to family,
advice, I mean,
what to be on the lookout for to be helpful, and not to fuss around people. They can't take it. I mean, when we first saw Eliza, we went to Italy where she lives now, and this is back in 22. We got there, and we were only able to see her for about 20 minutes every 3 days. That's all she could take. That may be all anyone can take of us. But it was, I mean, it was terribly salutary to realize that her ability to interact with people around her and even her environment was her only real response at that time was it was complete sensory deprivation. She was lying in the dark, a face mask on, headphones on, to block all outside, and just lying there. She wasn't able to sleep very well, and it was just,
Heartbreaking. I think your message around, and I'm going to ask you soon too about what message of hope you could leave to other parents and carers. But before I do, I think that the fact that you have that understanding that you could only see her for a limited amount of time, it wasn't her fault.
No.
She wasn't fobbing you off. It's not that she didn't love you or care for you. And I think that, in families sometimes there's so much misunderstanding about the messages that you're getting. So it's really reassuring to hear the depth of understanding that you obviously clearly developed for what the time frame was that Eliza could cope to speak with you.
And even now, we can recognize, even on a video call like this, we can recognize that we've gone on too long. We can see in her face, we can see the effects, and she's just got to when we basically just cut it off at that point and say goodbye, and she has to just go and rest. But one of the really encouraging things that for us was when we went to Mülheim. When she was undergoing these 3 hour treatments or more. And we were sitting around in the waiting room, as were many other family members of other patients who'd come from all over the world, but they all seemed to speak English and they all wanted to talk because here was another group of people who actually understood. And that's actually a terrible indictment of the public health position around this disease. That people are not just the victims of this, the patients, but the families are themselves cut off because it is so all-absorbing to just simply enable them to live,
It's all absorbing, and it also, others just don't understand exactly.
No.
They see you and they may think, oh, that's dreadful. But when people don't know how to react and don't know what to say, they tend to pull back and withdraw. And that leaves people like yourselves or the people with the condition isolated.
Very much so.
So you've given us at Emerge Australia lots of food for thought today about what better support mechanisms we can provide for families. A challenge is having the money to be able to do the work, which is always an issue. So I just wanted to ask you, just as an aside, how difficult is it for you to be living in Australia when Eliza's in Europe? I mean, you must travel a lot. Do you feel you're sort of on a roller coaster sometimes? What does it feel like?
Well, it's not a hardship for us to travel to Italy every now and again, which we do. But when we're there, we do spend a lot of time just, we have an apartment nearby to their apartment, and we're basically waiting on call when she's able to see us, and then we love it. But she is also has been out here back home for a few months now. She's just gone back to Italy. And so we've had a lot more time with her. So we don't feel that we're not seeing her, but there's a limited amount we can do on a day-to-day basis when we're here.
And the other thing that I think is the great unspoken right now is that we are still in a pandemic, even though we are past the emergency phase of the pandemic. So when we are in Italy, yes, we could be busy sightseeing all day, but we will only do that in an N95, and we don't really want to be going on a lot of public transport because we don't want to be taking COVID back. So we
We
do a
can't risk it.
Yeah, so we have high quality masks, and I buy buy tests in bulk, and we test a lot. So I think that's an important thing. We need to keep COVID at bay, and so people think I'm a bit paranoid wearing a mask all the time. Well, I don't. To me, I mean, I don't want to get COVID. When I have got it, I've got so sick, it's just awful. But importantly, I don't want to give it to other people, her and other people that I might be in contact with as well. So that's sort of the great unspoken. I just wanted to come back to that thing. So how do I feel when she's away? Yes, of course, there is just a lot of waiting around and when she's free and being flexible. But you said, what could we offer other parents as a comment or a hope? Would you like me to answer that question now?
That was going to be my final question to both of you. What
Yeah.
words of hope or encouragement have you got to other parents, other carers of their loved ones?
So I would say the thing the number one thing is believe them. And what they're feeling is real, whatever it is, and it'll be different for every person because we know it presents differently in different people. So the first thing is listen to the person. And I know Eliza taught us, and that's why we call a team Eliza. We're in this together now. There was a time when it was Eliza and it was us, and we'd chip in now and then, but now it's team Eliza. We're together in this. Secondly, get educated. I joined Emerge. I listened to all the podcasts, all the backlog.
Bye for now.
Not everything you read on every bit of myalgic encephalomyelitis is useful, and that being a scientist is helpful there. But get educated. From reputable sources, I would say. The other thing is that when you're dealing with someone who's sick, and obviously, some of the people listening are very severe, and they're just, my heart breaks for these people that can't even digest food and they can't get up to go to the toilet. I mean, I can't imagine how hard that must be. That's a whole nother level. But say Eliza's moving from place to place. She's in pain when she's walking. She taught me, don't talk to her when she's moving. She can't cope. All her energy is going in dealing with the pain of moving. Or if she's a bit short with me sometimes, of course, if someone is sick, they've got a temperature of 38 or 39, sure, that's all in the mind. Sorry, I'm just.
We understand.
Yeah, so say so she's got a temperature of 38. Your social filters are not working as well. Be patient. Don't take it personally. That's my advice. Just be there. If they can't cope with your presence other than 10 minutes a week, just leave it at 10 minutes a week.
So I'm just listening to you. It's just prompted one final question. And that is, what do you do to look after yourselves?
We go on holidays to Italy. I'm not sure. That's a hard question to answer, actually. I don't know that we consciously do.
Yeah, I
But
do. I practice mindfulness, We're both very keen on getting exercise, so we would exercise every day. I think we do take holidays, and when we do, we always factor in times away where we're actually like going on a hike or something where you're really out of touch from things. I think you do have to, using the Stephen Covey analogy, you have to sharpen the saw, you have to look after yourself, make sure you don't get run down. And, even though we're retired, we actually still just do a heap of our own research as well. And that is very absorbing. You're not thinking about anything else.
Such salient words of advice to our community. I just want to thank both of you for being so very honest. I want to thank you both for being such an inspiration, not only, of course, to Team, but to others listening to this podcast today. You've brought a completely different perspective that has been so helpful. And we look forward at Emerge Australia to being in contact with you more often and seeking your advice because you've lived through it all. And I'm sure there are many people here who are saying, that was one of the best podcasts I've listened to. So thank you
I hope
both
so.
so much for
Thank you very much,
thank you.
Ben,
I
and thank you
really appreciate.
for your work at Emerge. We really appreciate it, and
Yes.
I think the way the profile of myalgic encephalomyelitis has been raised in Australia is is intertwined with the work that Emerge Australia do.
There has never been a time when
Well,
there's more hope than now. And that's a wonderful thing for all of us.
thank you so much. So today's podcast is part of an Emerge Australia series that records interviews with patients and people of influence to ensure that the voices of those with ME/CFS are seen and heard. This is a platform where we can together explore the pressing issues faced by over 250,000 people with ME and at least 400,000 more with long COVID. Tune in again for our next interview. And don't forget, for more information and to subscribe to the Emerge Australia newsletter or to donate to support our work, visit our website on www.emerge.org.au.
You may say that I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. And I hope someday you'll join.